Today is the 14th of October, 2011. We are sitting in the Nixon Lounge of Hawthorne Longfellow Library at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. It is 12 p.m. I, Coral Sandler, class of 2012, am interviewing Linda Nelson, class of 1983, for Jennifer Scanlon's class on 40 years of co-education at Bowdoin. So Linda, I'd love to start by asking you what it was like for you entering Bowdoin as a woman in 1979 and how it changed over the years.
1979, it's a long time ago. The world has changed a lot between then and now, which is what's pretty remarkable. And I am actually from a family in which I'm the first person to go to college, so I did not know much about looking at colleges and did not have really support from my family to search. So in fact, I applied only to Bowdoin and got an early decision. It was a recommendation of some of my high school teachers. My high school history teacher's sister worked right here in this library. And many of my teachers down in Stonington, Connecticut, which is where I graduated from, were from Maine. So I had a strong attraction to coming up here. I visited over Columbus Day weekend, and it was, of course, beautiful, as it is right now. And so I thought, everybody says it's a great school, and I'm going to try and get in so I don't have to worry about going anywhere else. And it never occurred to me that it had been an all-male school until very recently. I guess that's part of what I think is really important about this story and why I'm telling you the background of it. I had looked at some of the other all-women schools because I was out as a lesbian fairly young when I was 15, and so going to an all-girls school would have made some sense. I looked at Smith, I looked at Wellesley, but very briefly, and not anything like I toured Bowdoin. So when I applied early decision and I got in, I was just relieved to have the college decision process done, to have been accepted at such a prestigious school. I was very honored by that. And I really didn't think about it very much until I got here. And it was a little shocking, frankly, when I arrived. It was I guess it's best described as culture shock. The fraternity scene was very big then, still. The fraternities had just been mandated to go co-ed, and they were pissed as hell, frankly. They were quite angry about it. So there was a lot of tension, gender tension, on campus in 1979. And to find myself, and I had never really thought about what an environment would be like that was so kind of dominated by historically, by very privileged men, men who, you know, really felt that it was their world to run around in. Because I came from a very working class family, fishing community, like I live in now on the coast of Maine. So all of that, the class thing was very shocking for me. The fact that it really still felt pretty much like an all-male school was pretty shocking. So I wouldn't say that I had the easiest transition. And I'll give you a lot more details about it, but I think what's important when I talk about kind of those early difficulties, is to know that I ultimately stayed at Bowdoin, came back to Bowdoin after being away, really ended up loving the education I got here and have been very involved as an alum and very appreciative of it. That doesn't dismiss or negate how difficult it was kind of coming in the time that we had here.
Thanks. So one of the focuses of this interview is the Women's Resource Center, and I'm curious what existed in 79 when you first arrived for women's organizations and what the timeline of that was.
I will give you the best I can remember. I'm kind of shocked to find, as I think about all this, that it does feel like a very long time ago. But when I did arrive, the Bowdoin Women's Association was very active already, and thankfully, because I think that's why I was able to stay at Bowdoin. You know, the whole first week was fraternity rush and seeking to belong. I would go to the fraternities and end up in beer-soaked basements full of, you know, people being rushed for fraternities, which was not really totally my scene. But there was a Bowdoin Women's Association reception, and I met there these fantastic women who were quite a very different world apart from the fraternity rush scene. And one of them, Melissa Roderick, and I are best friends to this day. And so that's really great. And we often say that the only, and we were both freshmen, and we often say that the only reason we made it through Bowdoin was that meeting at the BWA and finding each other and finding these other women. Nikki Beisel was the president then. Lori Friedman was really active. And it was just heartening to find women who shared our beliefs in autonomy, who saw women as a valid and kind of repressed voice here on campus and out in the world. And so the BWA was very strong, but that was it. There was no other, there were no other organizations. We started a gay-straight alliance during that time. I can't actually even get all the initials straight of what it has become, although I'm going to the reception later this evening and I know what they all mean. And we started a gay-straight alliance, we started a publication called To the Root, and we started the Women's Resource Center, and that all happened while I was here. So I would be interested, I think I said this to you on the phone, I actually am friends with a woman from the class of 77, and it seems like most of those women from the earlier, very earliest classes just pretty much assimilated and came through just like the privileged men around them and went out. And it wasn't really till the end of the 70s that the kind of fire in the pan started to sizzle a little bit, it feels to me like. And maybe it was because of the fraternities having to go co-ed. I mean, I think that really was quite a cultural stress on the institution and really was the first time that men felt really threatened here. I don't think, but again, I'd be interested in hearing some of your earlier interviews and hearing what women a little bit older than I had to say.
So, is there a specific memory that kind of capitalizes the simmering that was going on for you, or?
We had some pretty impressively awful things happen to us. So that's the fact that I am very supportive of the college and really believe in its mission and in all of the alum, and including all of my male friends from my classes. Like I said, it's pretty remarkable. We were able to start the Women's Resource Center, and that began during my sophomore year. We lived there, some of us, that first year. There was quite a bit of physical harassment of the space. It was, somebody tried to burn it down at one point. We did receive threatening phone calls kind of on a regular basis. Some of us were followed around campus. And it had somewhat to do with us being feminists, in the sense that I think there was real resentment about us saying that we needed our own space and our own voice, and why didn't we just assimilate? And this is true with all minorities. I mean, it was true, you know, it's true with African Americans, it's true. So I think there was this real sense of like, why suddenly are the women not just playing lacrosse and, you know, doing what Bowdoin men do? You know, what Bowdoin alum do? What is this fuss? Why do they need separate space? Why are they, you know, saying that things need to change? You know, why are they invading our space? There was there were two fraternities, one right next to the Women's Resource Center, Zeta Psi, that flew in the face of the regulations about going co-ed and opted to stay single sex and were dumped out of their national fraternity as a result. But they were adamant that there was no women going to be in those places. I mean, that's, fraternities were fraternities. And so it was a very, you know, so to have the Women's Resource Center right next to Zeta Psi, you know, I mean, you can kind of feel the physical tension right there. And the fact that we did personally get harassed and, you know, we were active politically too. It wasn't just like we were trying to make a nice little cottage over there with the Women's Resource Center. We were active politically. We were outspoken in classes. We were not shy wallflowers, any of us. And trying to give women a voice here, trying to bring a female perspective to things which maybe a female voice had never been brought to before. I think those were the really important things. I took a radio show at BOR and did a whole women's music radio show. And, you know, we just tried to be visible and present. And you know, our goal and one of the important things for me to this day, you know, the Bowdoin Women's Association was avowedly feminist. It was a feminist organization. And like the National Organization for Women at that time, with which we kind of allied out in the Brunswick community, you know, equal pay for equal work, some of the kind of standard feminist slogans at that time, reproductive choice, different things like that. But for us, it was much deeper than that. It was never just about, you know, we want equal access to make as much money and to have everything that we want. It was about how do we make this world a better place, and do that by inserting these voices that have not always been part of the public discussion, whether it's at Bowdoin, which was our microcosm at the time, or out in the larger world. So I think that that was really important, and I think that was pretty unsettling to the men that were here.
Ooh, it sounds like you were with some really strong women. And
there was a really great legacy, and actually several of them in that year, when they became juniors, several were older than I was. You know, they'd been here for a couple of years already. But several left and didn't graduate from Bowdoin. Several left and graduated from other places. Several left and just dropped out of school. I left my junior year and went to Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, for two reasons. One, because I was an American Studies major, which here was a self-designed major, and Wesleyan had that major. So I really wanted to do that. Connecticut was my home state. But I wanted a larger campus in a place that was allegedly, hopefully, more liberal and had been co-ed for longer. I was really looking for that. But the funny thing was, I got there and I loved it, actually. I had some great classes. I did some great music there. But I never felt like it was as academically challenging as Bowdoin. And so I ultimately came back here, which I didn't have to do, you know. But clearly there was something drawing me here. So as much as it was difficult and had challenges, I think it was, you know, obviously had more good points than bad. But that, you know, Melanie Fife, who was a year ahead of me, she was really instrumental and took a lot of the heat, you know, her senior year and my junior year when I was away. You know, there were very few of us who were, you know, out as feminists or out as lesbians, and women were still, I think it was like the ratio was maybe 70-30 or 60-40. We were still on the downside of the minority in terms of numbers. I was on the first women's softball club. There was not a women's varsity softball team even, you know, at that time. So you kind of see, I mean, we were, you know, kind of making it up as we went. And luckily for us, the college itself, apart from the students, was very supportive. I mean, that's why the college moved to make the fraternities co-ed and ultimately moved to abolish them. And for some, there were other reasons too, like in part for that. And it was the Dean of Students who really supported the Women's Resource Center creation and gave us the house at 24 College Street. So without that kind of support from the administration, you know, I don't know if we all would have left or what, you know, what would have happened, really. But I do know that, you know, I said to you in an email, I said, you know, I typically don't come for homecoming. I don't feel attached in that way. We did come for our 25th anniversary a couple of years ago. And I do come, I was here for the 30th anniversary of Bowdoin. I've come to speak on various topics. And I've, you know, they've done a feature on me in the Bowdoin magazine. And, you know, and I appreciate all that, and I appreciate the ongoing connection. But a lot of the people I've just named have never come back to Bowdoin, a lot of those women. So I think in some ways, you know, it was challenging.
So I'd love to hear more about some of your specific experiences, if you're willing to share, just with either those early years and what led you to get, you know, this space together for women and to work for that, and whatever comes back to you or you're willing to share.
Well, you know, there were no women's studies classes, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, women's studies didn't exist as a discipline. So there's the Bowdoin Women's Association, and I think what we realized was that, especially with the fraternity structure in which you had this physical structure of houses, that women really needed a space here. So that's where the idea of the Resource Center came from. Needed a space, needed a collection. A lot of the text that we were finding kind of out in the world, by feminist presses and feminist authors, were not in Hawthorne Longfellow, were not part of the collections here. I'm not even sure what happened to that collection that we created over there. But that was really, you know, to collect women's poetry, to collect women's music, to collect this whole burgeoning kind of separate women's culture that was developing in the late 70s and early 80s was really a part of what we hope to do with the space. But we definitely were hope, you know, what as the studies like with women's education have shown, you know, there is, it's not quite as true today, but during that period it was still very true that, you know, for women to have a separate space and a place to have their own voices kind of not being dominated all the time by men who felt like it was really their place and could do whatever they wanted to do, and women who were struggling to feel that way. I mean, because we were not necessarily, in my generation, necessarily raised to believe that. I think maybe my generation, so I just turned 50, right? So I'm really on that edge of that where women started to believe that we could go out and do whatever we wanted to do and that the world was kind of our oyster in the same way. But even the women a couple of classes ahead of me, you know, it was a real leap. And it's hard to imagine that now. And I think that's the biggest thing, because the world is such a different place, not just Bowdoin, but the world. So it's hard to kind of remember when, you know, women were thought of as secretaries. And I mean, but this was the late 70s, and that's when we came here, you know. And, you know, when women really, you know, weren't hired for certain things, and when we had to look a certain way, and when we had to act certain ways to our bosses. And so all of that is the environment in which our experience at Bowdoin was happening. So we really felt like, you know, having a separate space would be a great political step and would create a lasting legacy, hopefully, for the women behind us. I mean, one of the dangers, as we watched several of, you know, women leave here, and was that, you know, women wouldn't be able to carve out a space here, and that we would leave in 4 years and it would be just as, you know, just as repressive or in some, what's the word I want? Chauvinistic isn't quite right, but anyway. We really came upon the Women's Resource Center as a practical, lasting concept that we could leave, that could exist for generations of women coming to Bowdoin, that would hopefully create a kind of space that women could see themselves in and could understand themselves in. And I was thinking about it today, because as I told you, I was staying down in Portland, and of course, you know, all over the country, we've got the Occupy Wall Street movement going on, and we were big social change activists across the board. We demonstrated at the post office here in 1981 when Ronald Reagan reinstituted selective service registration for men, which didn't affect us, but we were the ones demonstrating down there. You know, we really were always in the streets kind of demonstrating for social change. And so I look at this social change movement now, and I'm very, obviously very supportive of it. I believe totally in what's being said and what the ideals of it are. But my immediate question I can see is always like, okay, so the Tea Party movement has been successful because they've actually gone from doing street protests to getting money to get candidates elected to making really substantial structural change because of the candidates being elected. So, you know, is this going to be a movement on the left that again is just nothing but tents and signs and good slogans and young people occupying places? Or are they going to be able to attract investment and get some candidates elected and really make structural change? And I'm using that analogy because that's what that Women's Resource Center was. That Women's Resource Center was us not just protesting with pickets and whatever, but coming to this administration, which, you know, was a somewhat scary thing. I mean, we didn't know. I mean, the whole institution felt like it wasn't necessarily ours at the time. Coming to the administration and saying, you know, this is what we think this campus needs for long-term, you know, change, for, you know, to really make women feel welcome here. And that's, I think, you know, what you want to do with social change movements. You want to think structurally and think, what is it that's going to make a difference 10 years down the road or 20 years down the road, and not just, you know, get the rhetoric out there. I mean, the rhetoric is important. I'm really glad to see people being engaged. I'm glad to see activism. I'm always really, really happy to see activism. And I hope that it becomes structural and that there can be some good good candidates elected and we can really make some structural change in our political system and economic systems.
How did you know to do that?
That's a really good question. How did we know to do that? I mean, the other thing about the late 70s, remember, so Vietnam ended in 75. We grew up with Watergate. One of my, you know, my two most visual memories growing up were the Watergate hearings and, you know, kind of really the lack of the falling of faith in our government between Watergate and, you know, Vietnam. You know, I can see those helicopters taking off in 1975 out of Saigon when we left Vietnam. And, you know, so, and all of that was accompanied by, you know, feminism, protests, gay people starting to come out, Stonewall in 1968. So, you know, the whole protest movement of the late 60s to the late 70s, we were in that. We were rooted in that. So, which was different, I think, than the earlier women who came here, who seemed to me to just be more willing to assimilate and more kind of, you know, willing to take their place in the class system. And, you know, but we were children of that, of those demonstrations already. So I think we knew from that. I think that there was a, you know, a sense, the late 1970s was a real time of distrust in our government. And then Ronald Reagan got elected, and, you know, I mean, I actually had friends who moved to Canada when Ronald Reagan got elected in 1980. So there was a lot of general cultural distrust. We were encouraged by a couple of professors. We had, you know, there were some professors who also were of that era and of that generation, who believed that, you know, we needed to make social change in the world, and Bowdoin was where we happened to be. So, you know, we needed to be able to do those things. And, you know, I still, these are my values still today. It's not something that were just my values when I was at college. I mean, the reason the whole mission and spirit behind my organization, which is a nonprofit theater up in Stonington, is about community development and social change. And, you know, constantly using our privilege, or as, you know, Bowdoin would say, working for the common good, to make the world a better place for those coming after us. So I think it all came out of that, which is why I think it actually works with Bowdoin, because I think that whole sense of using our privilege for the common good is actually pretty deeply rooted here at Bowdoin. And I appreciate that, greatly. And I think a lot of Bowdoin grads have gone out and done really great things as a result. And I'm proud of being part of that lineage, too. So that, I guess that's how we knew how to do it. I mean, like I said, we did start up a little newspaper called To the Root, and that wasn't, particularly feminist, particularly gay, particularly any one thing. It was social change. It was, you know, about what is the meaning of the word radical? You know, the meaning of the word radical is to get to the root of something. And we really believed, we, like the protesters today, that the root of a lot of this was economic, and that we had to really work for economic justice and social justice. So this is a weird place, right? So we're here at Bowdoin, which is one of the most elite institutions in the country. It's got the biggest endowment per capita of any college its size. You know, the money here is enormous. It's enormous. And so, you know, to think about social justice and to be hoping that, you know, our counterparts didn't just go to work on Wall Street, which actually I think the majority of them did, even those who were wearing bandanas and had golden retrievers while they were here at Bowdoin, and make more money, would do something, you know, really to make the world a little bit more equitable for everybody. So for women, for gay people, for immigrants, for everybody. And I don't know if you're familiar with the writings of the African-American feminist author Audre Lorde, but I knew Audre when I lived in New York, and I heard her speak at Hunter one night, and she had this amazing, deep, resonating voice, just incredible. And she was, all of her work was about social justice for women and lesbians and people of color. And she stood up there at this podium at Hunter College, and, you know, there were African-American women in the audience, but we were predominantly white women, a lot of us. And, you know, she had these little half-reading glasses on, and she stood there and she looked at us. She was a very imposing figure. She looked at us over her reading glasses, and she said, boomed out, she said, "And what are you going to do with your privilege?" You know, she wasn't just saying, you know, there was a lot, you know, stop feeling guilty about it. You know, those of you who got a good education, who have the privilege of being white, who have the privilege of being educated, get out there and do something and make a difference with that. And I firmly believe that. And I think everybody that helped to found that Women's Resource Center as a collective really, really believed that. And I think a lot of them still believe it and still work for those, for equity to this day.
It's really cool to hear. So do you feel like you were able to bring many people to campus with similar messages or with empowering words for the women here? I mean, what sort of events were you organizing through the Women's Resource Center when you were here? And
yeah, that's a good question. We definitely, I mean, the Gay Straight Alliance became very important, and we had regular meetings of that, and that was the first time that had been meeting. The events that I remember organizing the most were actually women's music events, because I was a musician and really interested in the cultural, how, as I still am, as you can see, running a theater, really interested in how culture can transform us, and shared experience of culture, whether it's music or theater, can change our hearts, you know, and not just our beliefs. So I helped to organize bringing feminist singers Holly Near here, Farron. We brought and did a number of concerts in Pickard Gym, and so concerts for sure, meetings, speakers. You know, I've since gone on. I was telling you earlier about my friend David Becker from the class of 70. He and I helped to start the Gay and Lesbian Alumni Fund, Endowment Fund for gay and lesbian speakers to come. I don't know. For the first, I was lived in New York after I graduated from here for 16 years, and really wasn't much in touch with the campus throughout the late 80s, and I was living in Greenwich Village during the peak of the AIDS crisis, and I, you know, people were dying all around me, and that was my community, and we were in crisis. So I wasn't paying much attention to what was happening up here. And by the time the 90s rolled around, and it was the 30th anniversary of Women at Bowdoin, and then I was asked to come up and speak, it was a little depressing to me because I wasn't sure we had done such a good job of creating a legacy that would feel like women could really be their own independent voices and be different and be and work for social change. And, you know, it felt to me like I was really happy the Women's Resource Center was still here. I was thrilled about that. A women's studies program, I think, had started then, was in the early days, 10 years ago. So I thought all these were really good changes. I wasn't sure, you know, with the few students I talked to at the time, you know, whether they were here, they would have been here anyway. You know, I wasn't sure if we had really made a difference in terms of who was coming here and what the demographic was. And to this day, I'm not sure of that. You know, I look at the demographic of the place, and my friend Melissa Roderick looks at it. She really works for racial equity. And we're like, you know, you know, so right, the last few years I've been really working to see if more Maine students, especially students from rural Maine, can get accepted. I think it's great. I mean, I know Bowdoin thinks it's great that 11% of the students are from Maine, but Bowdoin is in Maine, so why are only 11% of the students from here? I work with really poor kids, really rural kids in the school where I ran. A lot of them don't feel, have like the women back in the 70s, don't necessarily have the confidence to apply to Bowdoin. It's a huge cultural change for them to come here. A lot of them come and then don't last because it's just, it's such a cultural difference from the poor rural Maine communities they come from. So, you know, working for those kind of social equity issues, whether it's for our kids here in Maine today or for getting more kids from Chicago, from, you know, poor inner city Chicago in here. And, you know, I'm not sure. I guess we made a little dent. I hope we made a little dent. The Women's Resource Center was still here, and you're interviewing me for 40th anniversary of Women at Bowdoin. And, you know, but I think it's still a pretty traditional institution. And so I just say to all of the students, I mean, I try to get my kids in here. You know, I mean, I do, because I feel like I got a fantastic education, and more even than the classes, I learned about power and how to use it in the world. And I, because of creating the Women's Center and surviving here and realizing I could survive in a different economic milieu, I learned how to go out and be successful on my own terms, and that I could do that. And I want my kids that I work with today on that island to have that same experience. So I actively, you know, I interview kids. I'm one of the volunteer interviewers. I actively work to get my kids into Bowdoin. But I don't think, you know, ultimately, I don't think the demographic has shifted that much from what it was from maybe what it ever, you know, I mean, change happens slowly with these big old institutions, you know, and so you have to, ultimately, I think you just have to breathe and put your head down and just believe that it's happening, that you're making a difference.
So if you can look back to when you were a student here and when you started the Women's Resource Center, how did you feel like you were changing the campus climate? Did you feel like you were changing the campus climate? Did you feel like you were having an impact on that? And in what way? What were the experiences that went along with that? Or,
well, you know, we knew we were in part because we were harassed. I mean, if you're being harassed, A, you're at least visible, and you're making a message that's visible, and B, you're threatening somebody. And so that is a really signal of change. I think that visibility, which, you know, can be personally dangerous to people, and I don't even mean physically, but just, you know, even psychologically, that's why gay people say coming out is so important, right? Because the visibility is key. And I think that, and, you know, I think we shook things up. And I think the fact, again, you know, more than any of us, because 4 years is not a very long time to be here, and most of us were really here 3 years because we would go away and we'd come back and, or we'd drop out or whatever. So, you know, 3 years, it's like, you know, how much change can you make in 3 years? But that Women's Resource Center, that building, is still there. Now, I know it's really changed a lot, and I know the collection isn't there, and I know, you know, but a women's studies program exists now, you know, and you're doing this research, and, you know, so I think that, yes, we did make change. How did that feel when we were here? I gotta say, you know, one of the things that happened, it was all kind of, I'm sure this is not what traditional historians like to hear, and certainly, you know, I was fairly unpopular at 30 years of Women at Bowdoin because I was the only woman who was saying, you know, it was challenging and hard to be here. And there were women sitting right alongside me that didn't want to hear that and contradicted me. And I was like, okay, well, whatever. You know, so, I mean, there are always two sides, two and three sides of everything. One of the things that happened my senior year, there was a, this is before date rape became a popular concept or a term that we know about that we can use like that. But again, the fraternity scene was pretty strong, and there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of drinking in those fraternities, and there was a lot of crappy things that happened to women as a result of that. And one of the very privileged sons of somebody here, you know, it came about that a female student was raped, and, you know, our action was to, I shouldn't probably admit to this, they'll probably still arrest me after the fact, you know, we surreptitiously went around and wheat pasted his photo around campus. It was like right before graduation, and, you know, because it's like, you know, they get away with this stuff, you know, guys get away with sexual violence, especially privileged guys. And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. I mean, did it feel safe? No. We were really worried that, you know, we were going to get kicked out right before graduation, you know. I mean, so it was this kind of radical activism, but that brought issues that nobody wants to talk about, that nobody wants to admit to. You know, nobody wants to admit to the fact that women had, you know, there was a lot. And actually, that was really interesting. When we were here 2 years ago for our 25th anniversary, We met with women at the Women's Center and had a nice little gathering there. And they said the largest issue is still sexual violence. They didn't use the term sexual violence. I'm trying to remember what the term was. But, you know, issues of sexual violence, basically, against women here, still, it was their main issue that they were working on. So, you know, it continues on. But I think that, you know, we started to make that visible and started to say, actually, we're not going to take it, you know. Where it's something that's got to change. And whether we were actually able to change it during our time here or not, I think we put the stake in the ground. And, you know, that stake is then something to build on. And it looks like, you know, people have been building on it ever since. And that's great. It's great.
So obviously you had some, I don't want to use this word, but enemies. I'm also wondering about who was supporting you on campus. And mm-hmm. You said the dean of students mm-hmm. gave you 24 College, and there were a few...
Wendy Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
her name was. She was, the, you know, we had professors that were really supportive, professors in the government department, professors in the English department. And these were young, you know, young professors. They were in their probably early 30s then. I mean, they felt old to us, just like, you know, we were 18 and they were, you know. But, you know, they were young people who themselves were in their first jobs and saw what we saw here, you know, had come from other institutions, bigger institutions, places that were co-ed, from all women's colleges. You know, women's professors started to come here. There was only one tenured woman professor when I got here. And she was the famous sociologist. What the heck was her name? Margaret, I want to say Margaret White, but that's not right. She was a famous old sociologist, and she really hardly taught here. She kind of got here and got tenured, and, you know. But, you know, there were very few women professors here, even as women professors. So that was another thing we started, you know, like, come on. Like, we need women role models. We need these classes to be taught by women. And that slowly began to increase during our time here. And I'd have to say that I think most of our support, we were a small group. We were not a huge movement on campus. I can't say that, yeah, 60% of the student body was marching behind me across the quad. No, no. We were totally in the minority, you know. And that's why it felt like it did, you know, because it's hard to be in the minority. But I think that, you know, we made enough of a mark. I think, you know, when we came back for our 25th anniversary, you know, and, you know, classmates who were very traditional and conservative and kind of rolled their eyes at us in class still remembered us, and, you know, all everybody treated each other respectfully, and, you know, and, you know, they got their first taste of women asking for something different from our being in those classes. But it was the professors, I feel like. I feel like without the support of some key professors, you know, that it would have been really, really hard. Because we were young, too. And so we needed that adult support. You know, we needed that.
Totally. Yeah, so...
And I think a lot of those professors are not here anymore. But I know that... Maria, I'm not going to remember anybody's last name. Mm-hmm. See, this is the real. She was in the English department, and she and her husband, who was in the political science department, she went on to be head of women's studies, like maybe the first director of women's studies. She was great. Hunsinger, Maria mm-hmm. Hunsinger. Mm-hmm. She was fantastic. I'm not sure. I don't think she's here anymore. Barbara Castor, who had been here well before any of us and really kind of anchored the film department and was never kind of out of the closet but was very supportive of us, I think is a strong, she was one of the only other women professors here. But a lot of the women professors left too. I mean, and you know, some of that's career stuff, you know, because a lot of professors, they start as adjuncts and they start in these 1 or 2 year positions and they move around. But, you know, Nancy Fulbury was really important to us. She's down at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst now. She does really groundbreaking economic work. Joan Tronto was really supportive. She's a pretty famous political scientist now. She went down to Hunter. So, you know, all that stuff shifts around as well. So I don't really even know many of the professors that are here anymore. But I think that support was very important.
Yeah. So were most of the women students on campus part of the Women's Resource Center?
No, no. Mm-hmm. Most of the women on campus were, you know, we're athletes. No, I mean, so there's always crossover in the group. I mean, there are certain of my peers that you could interview that wanted nothing to do with sports here either, you know, because that was seen as another part of, you know, the institution. I was an athlete. I'd been an athlete in high school, and my friend Shelley Hearn, who I'm meeting here this weekend, she was a basketball player. I played soccer and softball. And so we crossed over into the women's sports world. But, you know, the traditional kind of college scene here is to be really good at academics and really good at sports. I mean, even the music department wasn't very strong, and it was lovely, and I participated in it and did some great things there, but it wasn't like, it was huge. I mean, June Vail had a dance department, and she still does, God bless her, which was really unusual, but, you know, it was tiny, too. I mean, it's a tiny school, and I would say the majority of students, male and female, you know, were involved in fraternities, because, remember, they went co-ed. So all of a sudden the women were, you know, the women who were fine with kind of assimilating into the power structure that existed, a lot of women rushed and went into fraternities. So that women were fraternity members and athletes, and you know, I don't know what the demographic looks like today, but I suspect it's not dissimilar. That students involved in some of the other areas are smaller, you know, smaller groups. So we were definitely a smaller group. And you know, there were some women, like I said, that really just were like, couldn't stand us, really, you know, homophobic for one thing. I mean, so there was really, I mean, it's all of these social issues intertwine so much. I mean, homophobia does not exist to the extent today that it did then, you know. We were like pariahs in some ways. I mean, that's what I think you have to kind of know. And that was self-chosen, so, you know, it's not, but it was just the times. It wasn't just Bowdoin, and I really want to emphasize that. It was the whole culture. I mean, later on in the early 90s when Katie Lang ended up on the cover of New York Magazine with the headline Lesbian Chic, and I was like, I was blown away. I mean, I'd been out since the mid-70s. I actually had created an identity in some ways about being an outsider, right? And I think that's true for a lot of gay people of my generation. We created our identities around being an outsider, being pariahs, and the change we could make from being on the outside. So all of a sudden, you know, 10, 20 years ago, now we're on the, you know, now there is no outside, you know, and that's weird too. I mean, that has its own, you know, ramifications for us, and how do you make social change, and can you be as active once, you know, what capitalism is very good at is kind of putting its arms around everything and holding everything so that it becomes much more difficult to be a bomb thrower, you know, and, you know, so that change is both good and it's it cuts both ways. I think, I mean, it was good that we were pariahs. I mean, it's a concept Hannah Arendt uses in regard to Jewish assimilation during World War II, and it's a really important concept, you know. There's a need in society for pariahs, and that's what we were here. We were the pariah class. and I think, you know, I'm proud of that. I think that was a good thing. I think we played a valuable role here in that.
Were there other spaces that women went to?
Not on campus. We all moved off campus pretty quickly, like very fast. So we had, you know, houses on the outskirts, and we hung out and had our vegetarian dinners, and you know, played lesbian music where nobody, you know, could hear us or come, you know, breaking windows or knocking on doors or whatever. You know, so we had off-campus spaces, but no, I mean, there were no other spaces. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the other, I don't really truly understand how the dining system works now and how these houses that were fraternity houses kind of work in terms of the social world here at Bowdoin now. But, you know, and I hate to overemphasize them because I certainly didn't hang out there after a while, but they were like magnet. I mean, they were a huge piece of what made this campus work socially, you know. So that's where people went to hang out. You know, they went to their, and you know, they went to their fraternities. And my friend Shelley became the president of Delta Sig. Delta Sig was one of the friendly ones. That building is gone now. That building was torn down. They were all Grateful Dead heads, and so they were like, you know, hippies, free love and peace, and they were a pretty friendly bunch. And Sayu, the green building over here, was another place that we would go sometimes too, that we would feel comfortable. I mean, there were a couple of fraternities where we felt more comfortable and where we had friends, male friends and female friends. And then there, you know, other fraternities were characterized more by like hockey players who were really overtly hostile to us. And, you know, there was a football frat and there was, you know, I mean, that's how the whole social world worked in those kind of little circles. And I'm hoping today it's a little bit more integrated and not quite as culturally divided up as that. I mean, it's been a long time. Hopefully that has changed a little bit.
Do you mind talking a little bit about the fact that that 24 College and the WRC was right next to one of those fraternities and what that was like and whether there was any interaction between the two buildings?
You know, so we went to Dean Ferry and said, you know, we need a women's center. And we firmly expected that we, you know, the expectation was we would get a room somewhere, you know, in the Molten Union, or, you know, you'd get like a room, like a social club or something. And she was the one. She's like, well, I've got 24 College Street. We're like, great. I mean, we didn't, you know, say, we didn't think, oh yeah, it's next to Sayu. I mean, not Sayu, rather Zeta Psi. You know, we didn't think about that until we got in there. And I think she had other, it'd be interesting to look back at her history of this, because I think that they, that the college was wanting to turn that into a small dormitory. When I got here, the only all-female housing left on campus was Burnett, which I had asked for. I was at least kind of aware enough to ask for that coming in as an incoming out lesbian. I was like, okay, I can at least do that. But then we moved over there in my sophomore year, and it also was one of the only places that they could make handicap accessible. I mean, that's the other big barrier here at the college, is that the campus was so inaccessible to people with disabilities. So they were able to just throw a ramp on that thing, because it was such a small house, and use it to accept the first quadriplegic student, who was a woman named Abby. So she lived downstairs with her a student attendant, because she needed to pretty much 24-hour care. So I think there were other motivations, perhaps, in, you know, creating the Women's Center over there, and that, you know, nobody really looked at the fact that we were right there next to this renegade fraternity. I mean, it was mostly, you know, I mean, we do suspect that the, you know, when somebody stuffed kerosene soaked rags under the shingles and lit them, that it was probably somebody from there, but, you know, we don't know. There was never any prosecution, there was never, you know, there was nothing. I mean, you know, we'd get stuff yelled at us, you know, it's pretty minor. I mean, it's, you know, you had to walk by there. We used to, you know, walk by and say, you know, Zeta was where men are men and sheep are nervous. You know, that was the jokes about some of these fraternities. And, you know, so we could, you know, throw little grenades too. It wasn't just like the boys, you know, throwing them at us. I mean, we were, you know, fighting back on our own rights. So, you know, we were kind of holding our own. But, you know, and then, you know, they'd all be out there in their little preppy blazers and stuff, you know, having cocktail parties and stuff, and just kind of, you know, we would just kind of roll our eyes, you know. But it's not like we were this really, it's not like we were holding events at which, like I said, like, there weren't like 300 women congregating at the Women's Center. I mean, it was always small groups of women and meetings and stuff, and there was some harassment that happened while women were walking around, you know, verbal harassment, and people being followed and stuff, but nothing ever got very, you know, so serious. And that's, you know, a testament to the good civilization that underlies everything, you know, even when change is happening.
So you say that the things that were happening were relatively small, but, I mean, but people did leave.
They did, and I'm probably the wrong person to interview about this, because I'm known, my nickname is EO, which stands for Eternal Optimist, so even my partner teases me, because I perpetually have a kind of rosy view of history, despite, you know, telling you that these things happened. I think, like I said, at least one of my peers at the time, Melanie Fife, had a much harder time and was much more bitter, and I think it would be good to interview some of those women that left and didn't come back, and to really hear their voices and to kind of understand what made them leave, and, you know, and what their perspective is on the college today. I mean, I would be really interested in that. I'm not in touch. And part of being disaffected from the college meant that I was, you know, I don't have 1,000 friends as alums. And, you know, I've got a very small handful of friends that I'm in touch with. So I'm not in touch with a wide range of people. And, you know, I'd be interested to hear, you know, what those women who left or, you know, didn't come back, I think that would be an interesting perspective to have. And I think there are some key voices of people that will never come here for you to interview that would be useful to this. I think that's because that's part of that Women's Center, you know. And but we were the first, you know, we couldn't save those women. I mean, they had 2 feet out the door or about to graduate or whatever, you know, while we were starting it up. But hopefully that wasn't as true, you know, in the classes after us. I mean, hopefully, you know, women didn't feel like they had to leave for those kind of, for feeling socially like pariahs or like on the outside or harassed, or like they wanted to go to a place where there was more equity for women. And that's, you know, a lot of women would just say, you know, I just want to go to a place where it's more equitable for women.
So we have about 10 minutes left. And I just want to make sure that you have a chance to say anything that was important for you to say, and just keep in mind that this is going to be on the website, and this is your chance to kind of add your voice to that history of women at Bowdoin, and or another chance. We've had some before, it sounds like. But.
I I'm going to end up repeating myself. I think that so I probably should just not say anything, but I do think that the legacy of those years from 79 to 83 when the Women's Resource Center was started is a legacy of women being really aware of how we can take charge of social change and of making the world a better place using our own voices. And it's my firm hope that by creating that structure there that subsequent classes of women have gone on to feel the same thing. And it would be even more my hope if I could look at the demographics of Bowdoin and really feel like, you know, the demographics have really changed, and or, you know, the women that leave from here go out and make the world a better place for people, and a lot of them do. You know, and it's very inspiring, some of the stories of alumni from here. And as I said, I think the mission of the college and the, what do they call it, the charge of the college, something, about being, you know, for the common good, I hope people really pay attention to that. I think that's really important. This is an incredibly privileged education to get. And I think it's hard to even recognize that when you're here, and it was especially hard for us because we were in that role of pariah, so we were kind of fighting, you know. And I come back to campus now, and I see the immense privilege, and I think, geez, I did not even scratch the surface of taking advantage of some of this, you know. I mean, because I was busy doing other things. I was busy protesting and, you know, doing other things. But, you know, that's why I think it's important that we try to get our kids from rural places and from the inner cities and, you know, kids that have not traditionally gone to Bowdoin here, because it is a great institution. You get a good education. You get to, you know, figure out how to make change in the world. And I hope that more and more graduates think about making change and less about making money. You know, I know it's tough. Everybody needs a job, and you know, and sometimes money does change the world. So, as long as people are using their privilege, like Audre Lorde said, you know, as long as people are aware of it and using it for those less fortunate, then I think that's really kind of the broader message, and that's ultimately, you know, what we were all about. I think feminism sometimes gets characterized mistakenly as women wanting equal pay for equal work. That was only just a part of it, you know. And I think now women of current generations, you know, are almost overwhelmed with having equal opportunity, because the women I know are still the ones primarily responsible for their families, even while they have really big careers. And I think that's pretty overwhelming for people. So there's still more change that needs to happen there. There's still more change that needs to happen in terms of, you know, how children are raised, and, you know, how normative traditional families work. As we luckily see, you know, non-traditional families expand, because I think those are really great for kids. Contrary to popular belief, I actually think, you know, the less normal families are probably better for kids in the long run in some ways than kind of traditional families. So. Those are, you know, that's the bigger message is, you know, this is a really rich nation, and Bowdoin is really representative of it. And, you know, we can't keep hogging all of the world's resources. And as students here, the students have a real particular, you know, by going here, we end up with a real, what's the word I want? A real requirement almost, I feel like, you know, it's like, you know, you get an education like this, and you're responsible for it. And I hope that students get that message, whether it's through studying old feminist tracts or the, you know, kind of radical writings of that generation, which was more about protest than current generations are, or is it about getting involved with Occupy Wall Street today? You know, whatever it is, I hope that that's happening.
Cool. Well, we have a few more minutes, and I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I really wanted to ask you.
It's been really sweet, and the last couple of years, two of my classmates, two of my best friends and my roommates have been brought back to campus as speakers for their various departments as really honored, you know, prestigious lectureships. Melissa Roderick, because she's at the pinnacle of education research at the University of Chicago, and she came back and gave the whatever honorary education lecture last year, and I think wowed everybody. It was great. I came down and met her and was here for that. And actually, as part of that, we then set up a link between Bowdoin and our school with the Island Schools Project. So Bowdoin is coming back to do that next week, which is fantastic and is a way, again, I keep trying to leverage the resources that I had access to when I was here. And Shelley Hearn is the head of the Pew Charitable Trust's health division and was brought back last year to give a talk on her area of expertise. And, you know, it's really great to see, you know, women of our generation really being acknowledged as alums and brought back for their work, because I think we've, you know, gone out into the world and tried to keep making a difference. And that's, I guess, the other thing I really want to say about the Women's Center, I want to make sure I emphasize, is that it really was a collective process. There was no one of us who were any more responsible or any more, and so I always worry a little bit about my voice being used representatively for it, because like those women that became before me, the Nikki Beisels, the Lori Friedmans, and, you know, the women, and Melanie Fife, and the women of my own generation, you know, it was, we worked as a collective. We actually made decisions by consensus, you know, and I always say that that has actually gone on to help me in the corporate world, because often I'm the only woman at the table, and, you know, I'm the only one who knows how to get people, I'm the only one who knows how to listen to everybody and bring everybody to consensus. And that's, you know, a direct result of those days at the Women's Resource Center and getting that done and learning how to work with consensus. And I think all managers should get trained in that kind of decision making, because it makes things run a lot more smoothly. So I just really want to emphasize that about the Women's Center, is that it was really a collective process. And if the Bowdoin Women's Association hadn't been so strong when we got here and so active, that, you know, we never would have been able to build that. That was the most logical step, I think, from the BWA. So.
And how many women were you?
Such a good question. We were small. It was a small group of women. I mean, you know, 15, 20. I mean, I think we felt really good when there were 20 people at meetings.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So appreciate having this interview. And
how does it fit with some of what you know about the Women's Center?
It definitely does fit. But thank you so much.
You're welcome.